here before we get started. All these mics are on all the time. Just let everybody know. So watch out what you may or may not want to say, okay? Welcome, everybody. This is our annual public meeting, we call it, actually, this afternoon. But we're glad we did this in Houston last year, and we're glad to be in the great city of Fort Worth this year. And reaching out to our constituents and citizens of Texas all throughout the state. As I try to remind some of the people at headquarters is, you know, Austin isn't the center of the universe. I think Washington, D.C. thinks they are. But so we're glad to be out here today. It's great to be here today. And with that, we'll get kicked off right away. We have a long day today. The meeting's called to order August 26, 2009. At 9 a.m., before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make. Mr. Smith?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State, is required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official records of the meeting. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. We'll begin with the Regulations Committee. Commissioner Friedkin, please call your committee to order.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First order of business is the approval of previous committee meeting minutes. Do we have a motion for approval?
Mm-hmm.
Moved by Commissioner Bivens, second by Commissioner Martin. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Update on Parks and Wildlife progress in implementing the Parks and Wildlife TPW Land and Water Resource Conservation and Recreation Plan. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of things I want to note for y'all this morning. One, thanks to the efforts of Senator Corona close by here and the work of Colonel Flores and others, there was legislation passed that's going to allow active duty peace officers inside the department, so headquarters police, park police, and our game wardens to be able to purchase their retired firearms. And that's a kind of a standard MO for law enforcement agencies, and so it was nice to see that formalized for the agencies, and kudos to Pete for working on that on behalf of the agency. Also, just want to call your attention, in mid-September, the 14th through the 16th, the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, along with the National Association of Conservation Law Enforcement Chiefs, are going to hold their annual meeting in Austin. So we have a chance to host them. Lydia Saldana has been our chief point of contact, although folks from throughout all of the divisions have been helping to make sure that all of our colleagues that come in from around the country are treated well. The plenary session for the meeting should be fairly interesting. All of the states have been struggling with all of the proliferation of renewable energy development and how it impacts wildlife, so the proliferation of wind energy development and solar and geothermal energy in places. So we'll have a plenary session. Should be interesting with T. Boone Pickens and Jack Hunt there on the plenary together to talk about their respective perspectives on the issue.
That should be interesting.
Don't always mesh. So if you don't have anything Monday morning and want to come listen to that, I would encourage you to. It's a very serious topic for us. Next thing I want to mention, and I've had a chance to visit with a number of you, we had the discovery of a very unwelcome interloper back in March, with the discovery by our inland fisheries team of zebra mussels up in Lake Texoma. And our inland fisheries team and law enforcement team and communication team have been working very hard to kind of educate boaters about the dangers of that exotic mussel coming into Texas. Unfortunately, our biologists have now discovered that it is reproducing in Texas waters. We found it in Texoma, we found it in the Red River, and now believe it has come into Lake Levan, which is the headwaters of the Trinity River. So this has very serious implications for water quality, our native fish, also our native mussels. Been a huge problem in the Great Lakes, and we were certainly hoping that would not happen. But it is here now. Our strategies that we are implementing, and in fact, I've got a white paper that I'm going to pass out that our biologists at the Heart of the Hills did on zebra mussels, just to acquaint y'all with kind of the biology and natural history and what's likely to happen here. We're trying to contain it to the extent we can. We're going to have to work very closely with water management authorities on water movement projects from basins that have zebra mussels going to water bodies that don't, and to see if we can get precautionary measures taken to try to stop it. But it's very bad news, and just want to make sure that y'all were aware of the gravity of the situation and the fact that we've got a plan in action being put in place to try to address it. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll conclude my remarks and turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Carter.
Well, that was depressing.
I should have ended on a sunnier note. Yeah, right. I'll do better on my next update.
Or provided a solution, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Thanks, Carter. Okay, committee item number two is listing of certain mussel species as state threatened, permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Matt Wagner.
Yes, you might notice I'm not Wendy Gordon. She's not able to join us this morning. But I'm Matt Wagner. I'm Program Director for Wildlife Diversity, and it's a kind of an interesting segue into our topic this morning on amendments to our state threatened list. And we're coming to you with permission to publish some proposed changes. There are 15 native freshwater mussels that we would propose as a state threatened in Texas. About two-thirds of these are endemic only to our state. Very unique organisms, obviously threatened by a lot of different factors, water quality, water quantity, and now the zebra mussel. Just to remind you that threatened species are those that are defined as likely to become endangered in the future. And under our Administrative Procedure Act, a 30-day notice is required prior to adoption. There are six species that occur in our East Texas watersheds, most of these within the Neches and Sabine River watersheds. There are three that actually occur in the Trinity River watershed in the upper reaches. In Central Texas, there are five species, and I don't know if you can read those maps from where you are. I'd be happy to list those for you, and we can provide that information. We just really want you to know the uniqueness of where these organisms occur within our watersheds. And then on the Rio Grande, there are four species that occur. All of these together make up the 15 that we are proposed for listing. So we're requesting permission to publish these amendments to Chapter 67 in the Texas Register for Public Comment. Should we get that permission, we'd be coming back to you in November then for adoption. Are there any questions?
Thanks, Matt. Any questions from the Commission?
Yeah.
I'm just curious, because in the materials provided to us, and you know, some are critically imperiled, and data only, in some cases one particular only goes back to 2000 and nobody's seen one since. Why wouldn't, I mean, it's threatened as sort of the first step. I mean, I know you don't want to
right.
jump to any great lengths to do something that you might regret later, but
well,
I'm curious.
The classification for threatened actually has the same regulatory status as endangered in terms of take and possess. So from a protection standpoint, it is the same. Our threatened list, though, includes additional species that aren't federally listed. And so that is the list that we have been modifying over the years based on our information. And a lot of these species really do need more work. We've got some research going on right now with a team that has been doing some statewide surveys. We want to continue that work to know more about the status of these species.
Thanks, Matt. Any other questions? Okay. No further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Thank you, Matt.
Great names.
Yeah. Item 3 is Interstate Wildlife Violator Compact, permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Major David Sinclair.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Major David Sinclair, Chief of Fisheries and Wildlife Enforcement. This morning I'll be seeking your permission to publish in the Texas Register the Violator Compact. During this past legislative session, one of the Sunset Commission's recommendation was for the Commission to join the Interstate Wildlife Violator Compact, and it was part of House Bill 3391, which was enacted, signed by the Governor. And you've got the authority, even before it goes into effect on September 1, to publish rules for the Violator Compact. The compact basically does two things. It allows Texans to treat non-residents just like Texas residents when it comes to violations, and that's just for the minor violations, mostly Class C's. We would issue a citation as opposed to in-standering the person for violating, and currently we do the in-standard, and that just takes up a lot of time. The other thing that it allows is if someone leaves the state, then their license can be suspended in the state that they're from as well as here in Texas, and it's just reciprocal and vice versa. As you'll see, Texas has been added to the map. Now the legislation has been enacted effective September 1st. 31 states currently are members of the compact, and after these regulations are adopted, we will be going to the compact, asking permission to join, and we'll be state number 32. Several benefits. Game wardens will be able to spend more time, doing their routine patrol, making contacts, rather than arresting a violator and taking them before a magistrate or taking them for incarceration. It also relieves the burdens on the jails and courts. For failure to appear, it reduces those non-residents. They just can't ignore now because they risk losing their license in their home state. And then the wildlife law violators put on notice that their activities in one state can affect their privileges in all the states. So with that in mind, staff request permission to publish proposed rules that would authorize the executive director or a designee to enter into the compact and withdraw from the compact, which was actually a part of the statute. Appoint a compact administrator to serve as Texas representative on the board of compact administrators, and then refuse to issue a license, tag, or permit. Now we talk about refusing the future purchase. Right now, we have the ability to go to the Texas Administrative Court in order to suspend someone's license, but it's a very lengthy process. It costs the agency to do that, and by the time we go through that process, it's probably easier just to refuse future issuance of license. And then receive information from and provide information to the other member states and process non-resident violators who are residents of other member states. Now, some of you that attended the March meeting, we talked at that time about picking and choosing violations, whether we should go across the board. At that time, we were thinking pick and choose. But after contacting several of the other states and finding out what they are doing, Indiana is the only one that I've checked with so far that picks and chooses the violations that they want to suspend or refuse. The other states are all across the board. And with that in mind, that would be law enforcement's recommendation that we do go across the board on all violations. When we talk about, and I think the example that I used was baiting for deer. Some states prohibit that. We allow it. But even in our own state, we have different regulations. We don't allow for the baiting of turkey in East Texas, but we do in the rest of the state. So, with that in mind, we would suggest that it be across the board. Now, when this goes into effect, that's the point in time we'll start with the suspensions. We won't be able to back up and pick up anyone that's already been suspended here in Texas. Kind of interesting in checking with the compact, there are 208 Texans that are on suspension in other states today. So I thought that was pretty interesting, but we won't be able to back up. It'll be starting. Day one will be a fresh new day. And with that, I would close, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thanks, Tim. Commissioner Duggan.
Does that mean that, for example, in California, where I think it's illegal to bait for deer, if a Californian resident is cited for baiting deer, that we will recognize that violation even though it wouldn't be a violation here?
That is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Okay. So, no further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item number four, migratory game bird proclamation, early season regulations update, and late season migratory regulations. Action item, action recommendation, Vernon.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Vernon Bevel. I am the program director for small game and habitat assessment, and I'm here today to recommend a proposed season for late season migratory game birds. This is the culmination of a long process that began back in March. We have a number of things to point out this time. We are still in the liberal package for migratory birds, and I think this is the 14th consecutive year that we've had liberal seasons and bag limits, and when we adopted the AHM adaptive harvest management approach to these bird stocks, we never thought we would be in the liberal package this long. There's a liberal, moderate, and restrictive. We are out of the Hunter's Choice bag experiment that Texas participated in the last 3 years. We're going back to a conventional bag, and that will require some modifications. We have an earlier closure of the duck season than the framework would allow us, and I'll talk about that when we get to that. We have modified the youth hunt weekend to not conflict with the deer youth hunt weekend. And there were a few changes we were making to the sandhill crane season in Zone C. For the north and south duck zones, we have the youth hunt that will be October the 24th and 25th. The regular gun season opens on the 31st of October and closes the Sunday after Thanksgiving, the 29th. It'll reopen on the 12th of December and run to the 24th. It could run to the 31st, but because we know from biological evidence that pair bonding is significantly advanced by the middle part of January, and there's considerable information that the early pair bonders are also the early nesters. Early nesters are also the most consistent producers of next season's duck stocks, that we're recommending closing the duck season a week earlier than we could on the 24th. Model ducks, we had a great deal of discussion at the Service Regs Committee meeting on model ducks. We are still at a variance with our data versus their data on model ducks, but since we're out of the Hunter's Choice experiment, they have requested that we reduce the harvest impact on model ducks by 20%. Model ducks are a species that you kill more of at the beginning of the season than later on, and so when we look at the per day harvest on model ducks, we noted that we could get to that 20% reduction they requested by delaying the opening 5 days. So on the sixth day of the regular duck season, which is November the 5th, model duck can be legally taken and be one each day for the season. And this is how this season breaks out in the north and south zone on the calendar for your view. The High Plain Mallard Management Unit, I always call it the state of West Texas because they get different hunting opportunities than the rest of the state, 23 extra days, and their season for the youth opens on October the 17th and 18th, regular gun season. Is starts with a very short weekend hunt of the 24th and 25th, then reopens the following weekend on Friday and runs through January the 24th to get in those extra days. And the model duck season, for those who might find a model duck in the out in the High Plain Mallard Management Unit, will be opening on November the 2nd. And this is how that calendar will appear. Now that we're out of the Hunter's Choice bag and back to the conventional bag, Hunter's Choice had a 5-bird total bag. The conventional bag is 6. We can harvest 5 mallards, of which 2 can be mallard hens. We're adding a third wood duck to the bag limit, which will be a boost for particularly for East Texas waterfowl hunting. We have a 2 scalp limit, 2 redheads. And last year, you will remember, I told you that we were the only flyway that had an opportunity to harvest canvasbacks because the prescription on canvasback last year would have called for a closed season nationwide, but there was enough harvest allotment within that prescription that the Central Flyway could finish its experiment. So we'll have a canvasback and a pintail season long this year. With the loss of the hunter's choice, we're going back to the dusky duck configuration for the brown duck, so to speak, and that'll be one of any of the model black or Mexican ducks. For the proposed goose season, the western goose zone, light and dark geese both open on November the 7th and run to February the 7th. Bag limit for light geese is 20 in the aggregate. Dark geese is 4 Canadas and 1 white front. And the light goose conservation order then opens on February the 8th, the day after the regular season closes, runs through March the 28th. No daily limit and no aggregate limit for that conservation order. In the eastern goose zone, it'll open concurrent with the duck season on October the 31st. It'll end concurrent with the duck season on the 24th of January. The exception to that is the white-fronted goose. In order to have a two-bird bag limit for white fronts, we have to take a slight reduction in the length of the season, so it'll end on the 10th of January. And again, bag limits are 20 light geese in the aggregate, 3 Canada geese, and 2 white-fronted geese. And the conservation order opens on the 25th of January and closes on the 28th of March. For the sandhill crane season, Zone A will run November the 7th to February the 7th. Zone B, which is a fly-through area for the whooping crane, we delay that opener and open on the 27th of November and run through the 7th of February. Both these, Zone A and B, have a three-bird bag. Then you get down to our coastal zone, Zone C, and we had a recent discussion about the opening date of that Zone C, and where we had originally proposed to open on the 26th. After we visited with the Hooper Crane Recovery Team and a number of our staff, we opted to move that opener to Saturday the 19th of December and run through the 24th. That we can only have 37 days in that Zone C season, and this gives us a full complement of the 37 days rather than losing a week. Two-bird bag. For falconry, the north and south zone, the extended season is January the 25th through February the 8th. The High Plain Mallard Management Unit uses all 107 days for waterfowl hunting within the gun seasons, and there is no extended falconry season. We had a fair amount of public comment. I think a total of 180-something different individuals commented on all the various proposals. And we, as you can see in these comment slides, we had very strong agreement on every one of our proposals that we put forth. And, Mr. Chairman, that ends my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you,
Vernon. I recommend
y'all
move this to the Thursday calendar.
Can you refresh my memory on the second season South Zone dove dates?
The South Zone dove dates for the second season opens the day after Christmas and closes Sunday the 17th, I believe it is, of January, the day before Martin Luther King holiday.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions?
Commissioner Duggins.
Can you go back right into the slide before that? Geese right there, no, back. Forward.
Sandhill crane?
No, keep going. It's the one where you have the comments on geese.
Oh, okay.
There. Under the proposed geese seasons where you've got a fifth of the... Well, you got 20 people disagreeing. Out of curiosity, what do you remember whether there was any consistency in the disagreement over the season?
You know, I talked with Robert McDonald, who does the analysis of the agrees and disagrees, and he said that there was the disagreements on most of the proposals were kind of all over the landscape. I will recheck with him before tomorrow and see if he can ferret out some pattern here on this one for you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Vernon.
Thank you.
Appreciate all your efforts.
Thank you.
It's a lot of work keeping all that straight. Item number five, no further questions or discussion. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item number five, harmful or potentially harmful fish, shellfish, and aquatic plants, special provision, water spinach regulations. Recommended adoption of proposed changes. Dr. Oldfield.
Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, other members of the commission, my name is Earl Chilton. I'm Director for Aquatic Habitat Enhancement in the Inland Fisheries Division. Today I'd like to discuss water spinach and proposed regulations for its growth and sale. Water spinach is native to India and Southeast Asia. It is in the morning glory family, as you can tell just by looking at the flower. It is one of the first plants that was placed on the prohibited list in the early 90s. Nobody seems to understand or remember exactly why it was placed on the prohibited list in the early 90s. It was probably because of the fact that it had caused problems in tropical areas in certain areas of the world, and it is a fast-growing plant. It has high protein content, and it can be used as animal feed. Water spinach is very important to the Asian community. About 30 years ago, immigrants that had escaped from the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia founded what came to be known as the Village in Rocheron, Texas. One of the vegetables they began to cultivate was water spinach. It's also important not only to the Cambodians. It's an important food plant for the Chinese as well as the Vietnamese. Indeed, in 2003, when we became aware that water spinach was being grown there, I had the opportunity to participate in a meeting with the Vietnamese Chamber of Commerce. There were 200 to 300 people there, and they were very vehement about their support for water spinach growth. It's important to the culture. Since the growth began just outside Rocheron, it's been grown and sold in restaurants and retail outlets, not only in Asian markets, but also in outlets such as HEB and Whole Foods around the state. As I said before, law enforcement first became aware that it was actually being grown in Texas in 2003. All of the production that we're aware of in Texas, it takes place in the Rocheron area. There are about 80 growers. They employ about 200 people. It's over $1 million industry at this point. Water spinach is grown in greenhouses because it does not grow well outside in Texas. It is advantageous for growers to harvest water spinach before it goes to seed. Productivity is significantly increased if they're able to cut it before it goes to seed. Otherwise, they have to start over. Consequently, examinations in 2003, in conjunction with law enforcement and some federal agencies, found that none of the plants that we inspected had gone to seed. Recent inspections for exotic species permits similarly found no plants that had gone to seed. At the last commission meeting, we discussed limiting water spinach production to the green stem variety or the upland variety that's used in Florida. One of the reasons is because it can be grown away from the water where it could potentially infest our waters. Since that time, I had a chance to go to Rocheron and visit some of the greenhouses there and inspect a number of the greenhouses there. And I found, and these are some of the pictures I took, including close-ups of the water spinach, I found none of the red stem plants growing there. One of the reasons for that is that the growers told me that the stores won't buy red stem water spinach. So it's not only won't it grow, they don't want to grow it, but they can't even sell it. And additionally, I found no plants going to seed when I was looking around. Well, the question is, how do we ensure that this doesn't happen here in Texas? In order to determine the probability that water spinach could get out of control in Texas, we conducted a risk assessment. Beginning in 2003, we looked in the Rocheron area where water spinach was being grown to determine if any of it had gotten out, if it was growing in the wild. We focused on the Rocheron area and downtown Houston. At that time, I helped survey areas in selected neighborhoods and in and around the Houston area, but I found no water spinach growing. I tried to follow up on all the leads I had, including people's backyards, and still found no water spinach growing. Even after the devastation of hurricanes over the last few years, where some of the greenhouses were destroyed, we still found no water spinach growing outside of the greenhouses, no water spinach in the bayous or the creeks in the Rocheron area or anywhere nearby. Inspections conducted in 2009 again found no water spinach establishment outside of greenhouses. After we were unable to find water spinach growing outside of greenhouses, Mr. DeRocher asked me to investigate the possibility of taking it off the prohibited list. However, in order to be conservative, we opted to look at other factors as well, such as temperature, tolerance, and overall distribution of the plant before making a decision. Part of the reason we think we can't find water spinach growing outside greenhouses is that researchers have reported that it grows well outside greenhouses only when the average daily temperature is in excess of 77 degrees. The average daily temperature for Houston is only 68 degrees. In fact, the average daily temperature does not exceed 77 degrees for any of Texas' largest 20 cities that I looked at, including Brownsville, which had the highest average daily temperature of only 73 degrees. Currently, water spinach is established in only three states. Small beds are present in only two counties in both Florida and California. It is present on several of the islands in Hawaii, most likely because it's warmer there. It's a tropical area. The question is water spinach acting like an invasive plant? Is it acting like an invasive organism at all? When we compare water spinach to what has happened with several other aquatic invasive species, we find that it's not acting like an invasive species. For example, giant salvinia in the upper right-hand corner has spread to 12 states since its discovery in the U.S. in 1998. Similarly, water hyacinth became so abundant after its introduction in 1884 that by 1898, the Congress had directed the Corps of Engineers to eradicate it. Similarly, zebra mussels became established in the United States in the late 80s, the early 90s, and within 20 years, we're talking about them in Texas now and also in the West. They've invaded the Great Lakes, the the Mississippi River, and are out in Lake Mead near Las Vegas now. Mm. Not so with water spinach. Water spinach has been cultivated and sold on a widespread basis for at least 30 years, with acreage in only four counties where it is established. It is estimated at less than 10 acres. The findings of our risk assessment were that water spinach, again, has been cultivated and sold for over 30 years. There's no evidence that it can establish in the wild in Texas. Texas climate is a poor match compared to the climate in areas where water spinach is native. I looked at an Australian program in conjunction, and I had help with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to do this, where we compared Texas climate with climate with where water spinach was growing around the world, and the match was quite poor. Temperature data indicated it would be difficult for water spinach to survive winter temperatures in Texas outside of greenhouses. Water spinach has not exhibited a propensity for rapid spread in either Florida or California. Again, it can still only be found in two counties in each state at a very limited basis. In Florida, it's just a few acres, and in California, it's just a few acres. Also at the last commission meeting, we discussed what the Texas Invasive Plant and Pest Council had to say about it. Since that meeting, they have had a chance to look at our risk analysis. And you'll find on their website, they've actually changed their position on water spinach. They cite our risk assessment findings and have taken a softer view on water spinach. Also, water spinach is controllable with herbicides. I've been in contact with the folks in Florida, And more recently, they've told me that with some of the newer herbicides that are available, it's actually pretty easily controlled. The new proposed regulations would allow water spinach to remain a restricted species in Texas due to its relatively low risk. Cultivation by permitted growers would be allowed, and unrestricted possession for personal consumption would also be allowed. Commercial cultivation would take place only in TPWD permitted facilities. These facilities would be inspected at least twice a year, in some cases more often. Under the permit, we would ensure that water spinach in these permitted facilities is not going to seed, that it's only being cultivated in greenhouses, and that only the green stem variety was being grown. Wholesale and retail outlets would also be allowed to possess water spinach and sell it for personal consumption if they retain invoices from permitted growers within Texas and from persons selling water spinach legally outside Texas. These are the comments we received so far. Support was about 75%. The reason I have a question mark under by the opposed is at least one person, and I'm not sure whether it had to do with the language barrier or what, but at least one person said that they were opposed to the proposal, but in their comments they said that they didn't understand why TPWD was going to outlaw it, and it really needed to be eaten, and it was very important to the Asian community. So it looked like they really didn't understand what the proposal was about. Well, are there any questions?
Earl, could you go back to the risk assessment slide real quickly? Few back. Okay, so water spinach has not exhibited a propensity for rapid spread. You may have mentioned this, but do we have any indication that it's spread at all in either Florida?
Not in Texas, no.
No, in Florida or California?
Yeah, it's been in the same two counties for years.
Is it controlled there?
Yes.
It is. Okay.
What do you mean controlled? Sorry.
As we're suggesting.
It's regulated?
Excuse me?
Explain control.
They're able to. Apparently, there may be it may be reintroduced for some reason. We don't know why, but 1 to 2 acres. Actually, according to the person in Florida, about a quarter of an acre shows up every couple of years, and they spray it.
No, I'm sorry. You're good. Clarifying question. So, controlled, regulated by a state agency, or not?
In California, Florida, is it outlawed? Is it regulated?
It's regulated.
It's regulated.
In Florida, they're allowed to sell it. They're allowed to grow it.
They're allowed to sell it.
They're allowed to grow it with a permit. They're allowed to sell it. I got mixed results when I talked to the Florida folks. One person said they're allowed to sell it outside the state. Another person assured me that they were able to sell it. They were selling it all over the state. So. But they are growing it, and they are selling it in Florida.
Okay.
What is the current situation in Louisiana?
I'm not aware of water spinach being grown in Louisiana. It may be, but I don't know.
Commissioner Douglas.
Mark, I can answer at least Louisiana's position, and it's last year it chose to outlaw it. January of 09 or 08, I forget which it is. They've taken the position it's on a banned list.
But we don't. Do we have the benefit of any of that research? So you're not familiar with the Louisiana situation.
From a
research standpoint.
Last time I checked with Louisiana, it hadn't actually been outlawed yet. But
I spoke
I
with a biologist
proposed.
There, and I'll give you that information tomorrow if we take it up tomorrow. I left it in files at the office, but I did speak with somebody and got the reasoning behind their position, their decision to ban it.
Can you share
yeah,
that reason?
Yeah, they said they didn't want to take the risk that they had found that too many species that they had thought could not spread had spread. She mentioned one, I think it was water hyacinth, I'm not sure without looking at the note, where they said biologists had predicted it could never survive in North Louisiana, and it was now being found in Arkansas, and that she also believed that spinach could adapt to greenhouse growing in a greenhouse and change and be able to make it in climates that it had previously not made it. That was a concern, so they chose to put it on their prohibited list in the last year.
Anything can adapt, but currently it looks like it's not growing in Texas. It hasn't been able to actually grow outside greenhouses, and I've been in those greenhouses, and there's at least 40 or 50 degrees difference in the greenhouse versus what's going on outside the greenhouse. It's like an oven in those greenhouses. It seems like it would be difficult to adapt, but animals do, and plants.
Well, zebra mussels, for example, we thought could never survive in the warm waters of Texas, and they've adapted and are now thriving, apparently. So
well, zebra mussels are acting exactly like invasive species typically act. If we go back to the to this slide, if we look at the species that we know have become invasive in Texas and have become invasive around the country, there's a typical MO. They come in, and within 10 to 20 years, typically they get out of control. If we look at giant salvinia, for example, we know it's causing us problems in Texas. It's only been here since 1998. It's already spread to 12 reservoirs. Similarly, zebra mussels have been here about 20 years, and they spread to, you know, nearly half the country. And water hyacinth was here for 14 years before it became such an issue that that Congress had to pass legislation to get it under control. So some of these aquatic species, typically, if they're going to be invasive, they become invasive pretty quickly, within 10 to 20 years. On the other hand, water spinach simply isn't acting like that. It's been here for 30 years, been in the country for 30 years. It's been widely sold, and it's had ample opportunity to escape greenhouses, both in Texas, California, and in Florida. And after 30 years, the best we can find is less than 10 acres of it.
And what kind of data do we have from 30 years ago? Is it pretty extensive?
From what? I'm sorry?
From you say that it's been in Texas for 30 years, or it's been grown in Texas for 30 years. How much data, or how precise is the data that we have from 30 years ago regarding, you know, the introduction of it into Texas?
Well, we know it has been grown in Texas for 30 years from eyewitness accounts. We talked to some of the people that actually colonized that area and started growing it. Some of the older Cambodians there, when they came over here, they started growing it, and since that time, as you know, there've been numerous hurricanes that have destroyed those greenhouses. If you look at those greenhouses, it's not too difficult for a hurricane to knock one of those things down. So they've been knocked down any number of times, and yet water spinach has been unable to grow in Texas outside of those greenhouses. As I said, those greenhouses are quite hot. Also, if you look in Florida, where in the Upper Peninsula, about the same latitude as Texas, where we're talking about, it's growing. Water spinach tried to grow outside greenhouses, but when the winter came, it died off on several occasions. So it seems to be temperature that's holding it in check there. But to answer your question, we have we've got eyewitness accounts that's been growing here for 30 years.
Sure, Mark.
In waters in the areas that it is native to, have they experienced uncontrollable growth in their waters and
in areas where it's native?
That it's native.
Well, it depends. they harvest it over there, so they want it to grow that way. So it's hard to say whether it's unrestricted, but typically where it's caused problems has been in rice farms, where it's invaded a rice farm, and those rice farms are ones that are wet all year long. We don't, actually don't do that here in Texas. They typically dry out once a year, but that's in tropical areas where it's caused some problems like that.
And I was going to ask it in if you knew of other states that had had this hunt prohibited.
That, I'm sorry?
Yeah, other states in the nation, if they have had this on the prohibited.
Well, there are 12 states where it's 11 other states besides Texas where it's actually restricted in some way. 38 states, it's totally unrestricted use. And in several of those, such as California, Oregon, Florida, they're allowed to sell it. They're allowed to grow it. And other ones, they're simply on the prohibited list. And there's just like it was in Texas 10 years ago. We don't know whether they're actually growing it there or not. But again, in 38 states, it's legal without a permit.
One of the things that concerns me in dealing with this specific issue is the adaptability of any kind of species that can occur with time or changes in the genetic structure. And specifically, I'd like to know if you know of anybody that's been at least looking at the idea of tampering with the genetic structure to change the way that this organism grows and to make it more adaptable to either temperature, humidity, etc.
No. All the operations we know about in Texas and in Florida are relatively low tech. It's like that. as far as I know, no one has been tampering with that. But in order to be conservative, again, we wanted to keep it on our list and only allow people to grow it with a permit. We're planning to inspect those facilities again at least twice a year, so that should we find it outside of greenhouses, we can control it like they do in Florida and or outlaw it completely. But that's why we want to maintain it and inspect the facilities on a regular basis to ensure that it's not getting out, just in case it should adapt.
Is there any substitute plant in the Asian diet or on the menu of Asian leafy vegetables that that they could substitute for water spinach? I'm probably going beyond your knowledge of.
Well, I don't think so. It's pretty deeply. It seems to be pretty deeply ingrained in the culture. It's like head lettuce is here. A good example is I was at a meeting in Arizona and I had a taxi cab driver that was Vietnamese, and I mentioned water spinach. He didn't know what I was talking about. But when I said Ramon, he said, "Oh, Ramon!" and he got fired up about it. Similarly, at the Vietnamese Chamber of Commerce meeting, there were 200 people there chanting about it. Ramon, we love Ramon, and so they were. It's really pretty deeply ingrained in the culture.
Yeah.
Commissioner Duggins.
Well, I remain opposed to this. I think I didn't bring all the materials I want to share, including the fact that our own department in the lobby of the building has an article or a pamphlet on invasive species, and water spinach is one that says you should not possess it in this state. Florida website has statements that are at variance with what Earl has told us today. They say it is not easily controlled by herbicides, that it's at high risk, that Central Florida and South Florida are at high risk. I think this is an unwise move. I think it's contrary to the directive we got from the Sunset Commission at the meetings in December, where we were advised that we should pay great attention to and do everything in our power to try to address invasives. I think it sets the wrong example for us to begin to play odds maker on whether this will escape, particularly that we're now going to proposing to make it easier for people to possess it. And I think it's foolish to think that people won't try to grow it on their own once it's easier to possess it. And There are other websites in Texas, including the Galveston Bay Invasives Organization, that have a different risk assessment for this plant. And so I think it's unwise and inappropriate for us to adopt this proposal.
Any other comments for that? Okay, you know, I think if I understand this correctly, we really have three choices. One is to go with the status quo, which is basically an uncontrolled exotic. The other is to control it in some method, which is what's been proposed by staff, recommended by staff. And the third is to establish some type of policy that prohibits cultivation of the exotic. And obviously it has a pretty wide reaching impact on a lot of people. I would suggest that we remove this, if we can, from the agenda for tomorrow's meeting as an action item, and get the benefit of public input, which hopefully we'll have that today, and also get the benefit of a little bit more research, particularly with some of the other states, and the benefit of the research that Commissioner Duggins has put together, and list it, if we can, as an action item on the subsequent meeting. Is that procedurally, are we okay with that, Ann? Okay, so any comments by the commission on that?
I'm fine.
I like that idea.
I think we need to hear from people today and tomorrow.
Get the benefit of that.
Get a benefit input. That side of it too, and we'll see if people show up this afternoon or tomorrow.
Ben, I think that's a good idea. I also, like Ralph, share there's some very, very serious concerns I think that need to be looked at in greater detail. Because, you know, we're looking at the devastation of several species in our state right now, and the last thing that we need is to add another one to that, and then find out 10 years from now that things have changed and now we've got a huge problem. And looking at the recommendations, that they're quite, it's difficult for law enforcement to follow the way that they're written up right now. There's also an issue of who pays for this. Proposed new 57.136 would require a permittee to be financially responsible for the cost, but how do you figure out who did what and where did it come from, and is everybody going to have to be bonded, et cetera, et cetera? And, you know, eventually the taxpayer is going to be one responsible for cleaning up anything that's left there. So I agree with you that there still needs to be an enormous amount of work before we look at this.
And that's a very good point. And I'd also say that, you know, I share that concern as well, and I think most of the commission does. Our mandate and our mission, part of our mission, is to make sure that we're very careful with exotic species, and we certainly heard that loud and clear from the legislature. So I want to be very cautious about proceeding with anything that that condones the cultivation of an exotic. So I agree with that.
Can I ask a procedural question?
You're asking me a procedural question?
I guess I should be.
We're in trouble.
I'm in trouble.
For the record, I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel, and I guess it's some clarification on how you want to proceed. Are you still wanting to hear from people tomorrow? Are you wanting to just pull the whole item from tomorrow's agenda and just get additional comment between now and the November meeting?
Well, can we hear from people tomorrow and still put it?
Still just,
yes.
Absolutely.
I mean, I
think we should,
think
because people may come.
Okay.
You know,
sure.
I don't want them coming and then all of a sudden they can't have their.
And they likely
minutes.
Will come today.
And I know
as
they
well.
May come this afternoon also, but I want to make sure that they, because it is on the agenda and it's, of course, been on our website, and so we may have people on. I don't want to send them away without them
so
being
we'll
able to
leave.
Speak to it. And then we can table after that, isn't that
yes.
correct?
Yes.
Great. We'll leave this on the agenda for tomorrow's meeting.
Okay.
We'll leave it on the agenda to vote. Sorry, Ann. It's on the agenda.
You have
but it's
that
not
option. I mean, you have that option tomorrow. You can vote or not vote. You know, it's still listed as an action item.
Yes.
I think you could just probably clarify that you're not planning on taking action, but you do want to hear from the public.
Thank you.
So.
Okay.
And we have the option of voting it down as well.
Earl, you've stirred up something here.
I should mention also there that for anybody that wants to, I can get you the name of my contacts in Florida, because there, it's been suggested there's some some discrepancy between what I said and the Florida website. For some of these, some of the states, there's often a discrepancy between what's actually going on and what's on their website. With Louisiana, for instance, I had to actually tell them that some of the plants on their website were native. So
we won't make it.
Anybody that wants to, I can get you that contact.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
all
it.
Of us.
Yeah. Thank you. All right, so no further questions or discussion. We'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Staying there. Committee item 6, crop depredation, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Mitch Lockwood. Here we go, Mitch.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood, and I'm the Whitetail Deer Program Leader. You may recall from the May Commission meeting that Director Smith notified the Commission of the need to publish proposed rules required or necessitated by legislation. House Bill 1965 amended the Parks and Wildlife Code concerning the permits to control protected wildlife, commonly referred to as the depredation permit. The amendments are intended to provide a more streamlined, efficient, and timely process for controlling wildlife causing serious damage to commercial agricultural, aquacultural, or horticultural interest, or that is a threat to public safety. Prior to the session and because of the numerous issues associated with depredation permits, the department formed a crop depredation working group, which was comprised of producers, Texas Farm Bureau representatives, as well as state and private wildlife biologists. And this group provided numerous recommendations, which were compiled by our staff. And we provided or distributed these recommendations upon request to members of the public as well as members of the Texas legislature. Ultimately, House Bill 1965 was filed, and it contained many of the recommendations of this working group. As you know, this proposal is lengthy, but in the spirit of brevity, I plan to address only those issues which were identified as most controversial during our meetings with stakeholders. Most of it boils down to concerns for permit abuse and enforcement. If there's at any point in this during this presentation, if you have questions on some of the proposed rules that I'm presenting or any other rules that I've skipped over that are in this proposal, we can discuss those at any time. House Bill 1965 authorizes this commission to adopt rules necessary to implement the provisions of Parks and Wildlife Code Chapter 43, Subchapter H, which again is the code concerning permits to control protected wildlife. Those who qualify for this permit include those who experience serious damage to commercial agricultural, aquacultural, or horticultural interests, or those who recognize a threat to public safety. The period of validity has generated quite a bit of discussion with the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, with the Crop Depredation Working Group. Shortly after the enactment of House Bill 1965, we created some provisional permit stipulations, one of which is that this permit expires on October 2nd, which is the day before archery season opens. And the reason for this was to try and prevent any potential conflict between permittees and the hunters next door. However, we realize that this permit stipulation does not address the depredation problems experienced by those farmers of cool season crops. One of the probably the most common concern amongst stakeholders is this potential abuse of this permit, as well as the expected difficulty for law enforcement, especially during an open season. Well, for example, if one's allowed to use this permit during an open season and he sees a trophy buck out in the field one night, might there be some temptation for him to go out and harvest that buck that night and then bring him back to the house and maybe put a license tag on that deer so then he could retain possession of that animal? We received several different ideas, lots of suggestions on how to minimize these risks during these stakeholder meetings, but in the end, we received consensus on the proposed rules. Staff and most stakeholders agreed that cool season crops should be protected as well, but that the permit should not be valid during any time before a crop has been planted or after that crop has been harvested. Now, I should state that we do expect Representative Darby or one of his representatives to address this commission tomorrow, requesting that this permit cover a period of 12 months. Still, to where it wouldn't be valid for use if there's not a crop actively growing. But the idea here is that a permittee would only have to pay one permit fee for one tract of land on an annual basis, regardless of how many crops may be grown during that 12-month period. It's my understanding that these proposed rules would allow us the discretion to issue a permit for 12 months or for an extended period or for multiple crops. Stakeholders and staff also agreed that a permit issued for public safety should not be confined to a specific season. And what we're talking about here, for the most part, I believe, is public airports, many of which already have a high fence around the runway, but occasionally a deer finds its way in. And staff believe that public airports should have the ability to remove this nuisance animal immediately. In another attempt to address this concern for permit abuse and difficulty of enforcement, we heard lots of ideas, such as how about allow for the harvest of antlerless deer only, or perhaps at least antlerless deer only during an open season, or maybe allow for shooting activity during daylight hours only during an open season. There are a number of ideas, and both staff and the stakeholders realized that with many of these suggestions, in one way or another, kind of defeat the purpose of this program and possibly the intent of the legislation if we're to create rules to make it so difficult to operate legally under. You know, in other words, you know, the reason we have a late spike and antlerless deer season as opposed to just a late antlerless deer season is because we know that hunters out there in a comfortable blind and high-powered scopes with good daylight do harvest spikes inadvertently when they're targeting antlerless deer. So we know these kinds of mistakes can happen, probably more likely to occur during nighttime activity, and so we sure don't want to create that kind of a roadblock, I don't think. Another idea is if we're to limit it to specific times like daylight only or out of season only, then it's not addressing the needs of the farmers who are experiencing these depredation problems in many cases when the deer are actually causing the damage. So finally, the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee members suggested that antlers from any buck harvested should be mutilated, whether it's open season or not. Just any time of year that this permit is used and deer bucks are killed under the authority of this permit, they must cut their antlers in half at the approximate midpoint. Staff agree that this would remove any incentive or temptation to go out and target quality bucks at nighttime and then bring them back and put a license tag on them. In fact, it should remove any temptation to target a big buck during any time of the year. Since House Bill 1965 states that neither the permittee nor others named on that permit may keep any part of a deer that's harvested under the authority of that permit, it may seem that alone prevents or removes some temptation for permit abuse. However, the bill also states that a carcass may be given to any appropriate recipient. And so we propose to define appropriate recipient as a person or public or private organization that utilizes the donated wildlife for the public good and not for pecuniary gain. And we believe that this proposal here, this recommendation, is consistent with the suggestions and the recommendations received from our stakeholders as well. We propose that those who operate under the authority of this permit notify the department not more than 24 hours nor less than 4 hours prior to any authorized activity. Now, this is referring to scheduled harvest events, planned harvest, where the farmer contacts the shooters on the permit and says, okay, show up Friday night. We're going to go out and we're going to try to address this depredation problem that we have. But we also recognize that there are times when notifying the department prior to any harvest event would be a hindrance. And for example, there are times when large groups of deer are seen in the field at nighttime, during a nighttime when a harvest event was not planned. And in those cases, we propose that the permittee notify the department not more than 2 hours following any unscheduled killing. Now, David Sinclair looked at some of the statistics yesterday on the permits that we've issued this summer, basically since 1965 was passed. And we've had 44 calls of notification so far to our law enforcement communication center, 19 of which were these unplanned killings. the calls after the fact, within 2 hours following the harvest, because we already have this as a permit stipulation in this interim period. So that could provide some insight, perhaps, as to the occurrence of, or the recognition that there are many times when harvest wasn't planned, and then all of a sudden they recognize there's a need that they have an opportunity to go address their problem at a given time. House Bill 1965 requires that the department charge a fee of at least $50. Now, considering the philosophy that this commission endorsed with other deer permits, and that is to recover any cost associated with administering and enforcing the program, staff propose a fee of $500. I think it's important to note that even with all of the potential controversy associated with this permit, the deliberations of the Crop Depredation Working Group and the White-Tailed Deer Advisory Committee went very well. And we appreciate the input and assistance that each of those partners provided. However, our staff's proposed $500 fee for this permit was not finally established until late in this process. And we have become aware of some opposition from members of our Crop Depredation Working Group, specifically producers. At least a couple of them think that it will reduce participation in this program. And over the last few days, we've received quite a bit of comment, phone calls from people operating under this permit with some different ideas. Ideas such as a reduced fee, maybe one phrase is maybe we could meet in the middle. I've heard a figure of $250. I've heard a suggestion of $100. But the idea is if they could start with a fee less than $500 at this time until the department obtain some data on how much time we actually do spend administering and enforcing this program, and then propose a fee based on those data at that time. One thing I should make real clear is this estimate right here is we didn't have the luxury of like we did with, say, the deer breeder permits or the triple T permits where we had years of data. We go and look at the codes that we charge our time to, and we know how much time we're putting into those permits. And so it was much easier to defend. In this case, we don't have those data yet. And so, at least not operating under these procedures since 1965. And so what these are estimates on what each staff member that's involved in this believes that we will spend on each permit, from administrative staff to wildlife biologists to law enforcement. And so again, the most common suggestion we've received in the last few days is, maybe before we go to $500, you get a year or two of data so that you have those data to justify this proposal. Nearing the end, I will mention a couple of the prohibited acts that are in this proposal. These are further attempts to minimize abuse of this permit. First, we propose that it is an offense to offer or accept money or anything of value in exchange for participation in activities under a depredation permit, except for employees. In other words, except for someone who works for the farm and part of their job duties is to kill deer as authorized by this permit. And again, we propose to require that antlers be destroyed immediately by cutting the beams in half as described in this proposal. We've received 30 comments. This slide shows 28. We received a couple of more yesterday. On this item, it is still a 50-50 split for those two additional comments. Among those reasons cited for opposition is that the public should be given the opportunity to harvest depredating wildlife. I think this is an idea of maybe another opportunity out there to provide some more hunting opportunity, but I think we should be very clear not to confuse this activity with hunting. And our White-Tailed Deer Advisory Committee, members of that committee, wanted to be real clear to make that point as well. We also heard that these rules are too complicated, there's too much paperwork involved. We also heard that the department should ensure that wildlife populations are not adversely impacted. And we certainly do not disagree with that comment. In the case of white-tailed deer, we truly don't have any resource concerns if we, under these rules as proposed. And the same is true for the case of our desert big game species as well, with mule deer and pronghorn sheep, and even bighorn sheep, pronghorn antelope, and even bighorn sheep if we were to ever issue a permit in that case. You don't see much reference to those desert big game species in those proposals because the statute in itself is pretty clear that there's some more sideboards, if you will, when it comes to administering or issuing this permit for those species that are more vulnerable. We did hear a comment about the methods and means. As proposed in here, it shows that it proposes that centerfire rifle is the only means which can be used to kill some of these big game species. And we received a comment that we should consider shotguns with slugs in some cases. We do understand that there could be some extenuating circumstances when the use of a shotgun could be beneficial and acceptable. And the commission could decide to amend this rule to state that means and methods could be described in permit stipulation. But for the record, I just want to be clear that we do intend that in by far most cases to limit the use or the means to centerfire rifle, as it is the most efficient means and for achieving their goals under this permit. One last comment I would like to make under public comment is that just last night I received a letter from Texas and Southwestern Cattle Raisers Association. It was addressed to you, Chairman, and I don't know if you've seen it yet, but they do support this proposal, but they do urge the department to monitor and enforce this program closely. And again, they specifically referenced some concerns for the desert big game species. That concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Anyone want a
question?
Do you have any idea how many man hours this is going to eventually consume within the department?
I have an idea of how many man hours we predict it to consume per permit, which is how we establish this fee. And I've just flipped to that page right now. We're expecting, if you don't mind, I'll just give it to you in an itemized format. But we're expecting 30 minutes of our district leader's time for each permit application. We're expecting, let's see here, from a law enforcement standpoint, we're expecting 30 minutes on each call, but we're also expecting approximately three visits out to the site by law enforcement per permit, based on an estimate of 12 calls of notification per permit. So about 25% of the calls, they plan on going out there that night and checking the activities. And so there's an average of 2 hours per visit. And so you're looking at 6 hours on law enforcement visits at that point. Our wildlife biologist time, for the most part, we're looking at about a 4-hour site inspection per permit. In some cases, especially in the case of the desert big game species, where we must provide recommendations that the permittee must follow prior to receiving this permit, we would then have more time invested into it. And we're estimating about 12 hours of time from wildlife biologist field staff. I'm kind of going through this item by item, and I think I pretty well have it covered. From administrative staff standpoint, we were estimating approximately 1 hour of time per permit. I believe I have it there. The total estimate when we calculate the salary for each one of these staff members, we came up with a figure of $485. Simply anticipated hours per permit times their salary was $485, and we rounded up to $500 for this proposal.
And we just code it and watch it and see what it turns out to be exactly, right? Obviously, like any other program. Can you go through those again, the slides? Just start at the beginning, and I'll stop you. I'm sorry, I don't have a page reference, but just a couple
you
of questions.
Bet.
Maybe a little slower, sorry. get to destruction in a minute. The one more.
That's the first slide.
Did you just go through all of them?
Yes, sir.
Notification. Do you have a notification slide? I didn't see it.
Notification is, I raced through that one.
Do we, Mitch, do we have a system where we could, where somebody, I'm a little concerned about someone calling in 2 hours later in terms of potential abuse. Do we have a system where somebody can call an automated, you know, I don't know the extent of our automated system, but where someone could call in and leave a message or get a number from the system, you know, an authorization number, and then they write that down, and that's their authority to go ahead and conduct those activities. So if they see a deer at 2 in the morning and need to take care of the situation, they would have that number. Some way to get people on record as calling into the department and indicating that they're activating, you know, their permit. Are we able to do that or not?
The number they call is a 24-hour line that is manned, and so...
Oh, it's manned?
Yes. And I invite David Sinclair to push me out of the way anytime he hears something wrong.
Okay. So, so one thing we could consider is, you know, of course, this was the recommendation of the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, the second point, wasn't it?
This is currently a permit stipulation that was supported. I should stop and not get too far with that one. This is an item that actually we did not spend much time talking about with the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. This is something that was mentioned as kind of like we're doing here, as I went through some slides during the first time, and then we went through a second run and discussed each at length. And during the first pass, I mentioned this question on whether or not we should allow any unplanned killing of wildlife. But to be quite honest, getting so wrapped up in many of these other items, we did not revisit that. So it would not be fair for me to say that this has been endorsed by the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee.
But this is the way it is right now.
Yes, sir. Under stipulation.
And it has worked this way.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
On this point?
Yeah.
Please.
Now, my question, just for my edification, is under 65221, you separate out mule deer, pronghorn, and desert bighorn. And then you come along with this. If I get a permit for one of those three species, can I call in 2 hours? Does this apply to that permit for those three species?
My understanding is that this would apply for any wildlife that you have a permit to control.
Well, that was when I read through this, that made me a little uncomfortable that would apply to those three, which
that's
are more sensitive, because it's an opportunity that I can see when in white-tailed deer that you've got to take advantage of the opportunity.
And
it seems like that, I don't know, it just troubles me.
You make a good point, I think,
yeah.
and many share that your concern, and that's the reason why in the beginning of this process we have more sideboards, if you will, on this when it comes to those species. I would be surprised if we issue many permits to desert big game at all. And for example, for desert big game species, the statute requires that we continue with the process under the old statute that says that we must provide recommendations to an applicant, which he must heed prior to receiving this permit. And I'll tell you that it's our intention that one of those recommendations is most likely to include a high fence for mule deer to keep deer out and a net wire fence for pronghorn antelope.
But could you just amend it to say under the second bullet point that excludes any permits granted under 65221G? Or is that...
And potentially the first bullet point could apply to those other species,
yes.
Some modification of that, or 24-hour notices is
Yeah, if I'm going to go out
required.
and under that permit... shoot a mule deer, pronghorn antelope, or a bighorn sheep.
Right.
I think the first bullet point would apply. You got to call and tell them. I just don't see that as being so opportunistic.
One thing I think is worth mentioning, I look to Ann as I make this comment, is one reason why notification is included in these rules is because the statute specifically references notification as, mm-hmm. as one of the items that the commission has authority to make rules on. but I would suspect that this could be one case where this rule could state that a permittee would be required to notify the department as described in a permit stipulation as well, and then it could be more specific on a case-by-case basis. I'm looking to Ann for a head shake or a nod.
That's my only comment on this.
Well, also, let's reference, Bighorn Sheep are not going to be involved in this. They're not going to ever get a permit to do that. I mean, it's not going to happen.
Well, 1965 rest references in them, but I do not see it happening.
Yeah. We've never done one, have we?
No,
to my knowledge. Okay.
Ann?
I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel, and we could either make the change that Commissioner Morian wants, which would be a very simple change to do. As Mitch mentioned, there are already more restrictions for the desert species, so we're going to be very much more involved in those permits in terms of inspections and that sort of thing. So that would be an easy fix. Alternatively, we could also, if you like, put something about notification. You know, it's set out in the permit.
Either way would be fine. I mean, it's simple to add down there at the bottom, just accept for permits granted under Section 65221G.
Right. And then the other point that I'm not, and I don't know if we're trying to change this too much, Ann, but the other one that I'm not particularly in favor of is the 2 hours following an unscheduled killing. You know, I wonder if we can put language in there that stipulates that a permittee needs to call in and get an authority number, authorization number, based on the permit that they have, and they're granted a number, or they're somehow on record indicating to the department that they intend to take action on the permit. I don't know if that's administratively, you know, too cumbersome given the existing system or not, but I just need more input on that.
Are you thinking that when he receives this authorization number, it would be valid for a 4 to 24 hour period, or
I hadn't thought that far about it, but I just think it helps us with the situation of someone potentially abusing it and taking a considerable buck and then calling in later based on the permit. The possibility of abuse, I think, is reduced.
Mr. Chairman, I think it might be helpful if we have law enforcement come up and explain how the law enforcement dispatch works.
Okay.
And how the notification comes in and how that's manned and staffed.
That would help us. Thank you.
We could do that.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Major David Sinclair. The Law Enforcement Communication Center in Austin is the one accepting those calls now. It's 24/7, so they're receiving those. We could... It would be great if had to have a call just before they did the shooting, as opposed to two hours after. I actually just went around the state. We did ledge updates, and that was really this concern about the 2 hours after and the night hunting during the season were the two main concerns for the game wardens. Yeah. But they're going to be okay with whatever we do. But this would certainly be advantageous.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you. Please.
Yes, a couple of concerns that I have regarding all this is, first of all, we're dealing with something that's causing serious damage. And I think I would have a problem with somebody calling at 2 o'clock in the morning saying that they killed something at 1 o'clock in the morning because one particular animal was causing serious damage. So I have a real problem with the call afterwards. I think my opinion would be that it should be done before, and that there should be a time limit, because otherwise we're going to have the poor game wardens working 24 hours a day during deer season, and we can't ask much more of those poor wardens out on the field. And so unless there's just some kind of animal that comes out at 3 o'clock in the morning and only at 3, I don't see why we can't say, look, this has to be limited to sunset to midnight or some reasonable time that our game wardens know that at that time they may be people out there trying to protect their crops, but at the same time be reasonable about it. I mean, unless there's been comments otherwise that it has to be done all night long, I just don't see why it has to be all night long. The animals come out to feed at sunset.
Especially if they're comfortable.
Right. I think from what I hear from farmers, they tend to agree with you too, since they're in the field all day and they don't want to be up all night either. I think you make a very good point. If I may make a suggestion,
please.
One reason with this, with the not less than 4 hours nor more than 24 hours prior to, is my understanding, is to give law enforcement the ability to make some plans to go out there and check up on things. And I think that's why we have the not less than 4 hours prior to. But what I'd like to ask you, Chairman, Commissioner Friedkin, and others, is if law enforcement were to agree to this, if we went to only a prior notification but reduced that four-hour window. I heard Major Sinclair a minute ago say we'd prefer they call right before any killing activity, and I don't know if he meant literally right before, and I'd like to visit with him, but if that's the case, would that be something that would be palatable, is that all prior notification but would allow a call immediately prior to going out in the field, or whether we should maintain a four-hour window?
Because these are permitted people already.
Yes,
you've already given them the permit.
Right.
The wildlife biologist has already visited. All the things have been done appropriately. I don't mind considering the fact that they have to call at least, as they're pulling the trigger kind of thing. But I want to make sure everybody on the commission understands, remember, the legislature has legislated this. So what we're trying to do is come up with regs that make sense, not only for the constituent who is the farmer or whoever's has depredation going on, but also for ourselves and for our law enforcement and for everybody else, that this is a workable plan. And I think it's going to take some time to figure out what makes sense. I also want to remind everybody, remember, this has been in place at some level for, what did you tell me, since 65, if I remember. Isn't that correct, Mitch? Or help me, 68?
I don't know offhand, Chairman.
Yeah. But so we're kind of up in the ante here. But I think, we're talking about people that are seriously being affected, and we need to support them. I'm talking about the constituents who are having depredation. So I just want to make sure we don't get too complicated. It looks to me like, Dan, one of the things you're talking about, Dan, Commissioner Friedkin, is that could you notify right before? I think we ought to try to discuss that overnight, and let's talk about it again tomorrow on that particular issue.
Got it.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't have, I think that's a good suggestion, Mitch. Understand that we obviously don't want this to become too cumbersome, because it's going to be a drain on the department and the resources that we're already thinly spreading. But Major Sinclair.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, the call that I was referring to was for the unscheduled. Like the 4 hours.
That's what we're talking about.
The unscheduled is the immediate call would be work much better.
Commissioner Duggins.
I join the rest of you have commented about the second bullet point. I think it defeats the purpose of the notice provision, and I don't think it is unreasonable or burdensome on a permittee to give a call 4 hours prior to attempting to take deer on a permit, and although I could live with 2 hours as well. But I do think that second bullet point completely defeats the purpose of the notice provision, which is to enable a warden to monitor the activity. Because as I've said before, I think this is going to create a great deal of abuse, particularly with winter crops, people contending that wheat fields are commercial because they've got some cattle on there, and then trying to figure out how to game the system. And if we have after-the-fact reporting, only if they kill, a warden has no opportunity to check that. So I'd like to see us delete that. And I have a number of other comments to the proposed language, but I don't know whether you want them today or tomorrow. It's up to you, Mr.
Chairman. I think it'd be helpful to get it all out. I think just so on notification, we're going to look at that.
Yes, sir. I think you all make very good points, and I'd be prepared to present this tomorrow without that second bullet included. We have already found out that won't cause a problem as far as being able to adopt still if we remove that bullet. And again, this is not something that the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee even discussed much at all. So,
and given our system, we would also be able to reduce the 4 hour to.
Well, it sounds like we could. Listening to Major Sinclair just now, it may not be desirable, and that's my point with you. I think my main question was if law enforcement and wildlife came up with a time, whether it be 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hours, if the commission, if that satisfied your request.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So I just want to make sure we're clear on this. On this, we're gonna excise that second bullet when we come forward tomorrow. So that's not going to be part of the proposal. And then on the first one, we'll reflect a little bit more about how much advance notice is required to give the communication center, and then we'll come back and talk about that tomorrow.
Agree. And I'm all for efficiency and simplicity, but I think we also need to indicate, you know, more than 24 hours, less than 4 hours prior, or whatever that ends up being, an hour or whatever it is, to any authorized activity, and then the term, the period that essentially that notification is valid for. I think we need to define that.
Yes, sir.
But I share Commissioner or Chairman Holt's concern that, you know, we don't want to try to make something that's already fairly complex more complex. We want to make it more efficient when possible. Commissioner Duggan's other comments, please.
Well, if you'll turn to page 190 in the book, or 189, rather, where we actually start with the proposed language. I think the definition of commercial interest is overbroad. And I've shared all these comments with Clayton last week, and so this is no surprise to Mitch and Clayton. I think it's overbroad because I question, well, as written, it would appear to me that someone could plant a 10-acre wheat field and graze cattle on there, and that would constitute a commercial interest as it's currently written. So I ask that we consider, at least as to a winter or cool season plant, whether we should have some minimum acreage there. I don't say I'm not insisting on it. I'm just asking that we think about, should there be some minimum acreage so that it's truly a commercial operation and not just being used as an attractant for game. Something to think about. In item 2B, in addition to the items that are can be required, such as sales receipts, I believe we should require a permittee to provide an income statement, which they're going to have anyway if it's a commercial operation, to prepare a tax return. But if we ask for that, we should be able to see their income statement for that particular aspect of the operation.
Just to establish the commercial viability.
To establish that it's a legitimate commercial operation.
Ooh. I can tell you that would create a major issue in the legislators' minds. That's not what we do, okay, at Texas Parks Wildlife. So I'm not trying to get in a disagreement or argument with you, Commissioner Duggins, but, to sit there and ask somebody for an income statement because they're trying to protect their crops, that's a little heavy-handed, in my opinion. I'd have to disagree on that one. Sorry.
Well,
I'm just going to bring it up right away so that we don't keep moving on to some of this stuff. Because
It says we may require sales receipts.
Yeah, you're already asking for sales receipts, tax receipts, or other things. So the documentation in there is already, in my opinion, appropriate.
And the department is going through a process to vet the permittees prior to issuing the permit.
Well, in my view, as written in it, the definition should be broad enough to require a permittee to produce an income statement if asked. But that's the way this is worded. It says that we may require additional information, and it doesn't define or limit additional information.
Just leave it.
So all I'm pointing out is if we suspect that it's not a legitimate commercial operation, my interpretation of that language is that it would permit us to ask for an income statement.
That's why I like the way this is written. Or it says, or other documentation. Okay? Acceptable to the department indicating that agriculture, horticulture, et cetera, are being erased the property. So, and that's going to be all part of getting the permit to begin with. Okay. Not after the fact, but before the fact.
Right.
That's the way I understood it.
That's correct, okay. Chairman. Actually, if we thought it was necessary, as you said, this does allow us the authority to request an income statement as well as the rule is written now.
That's all I wanted to hear, so that it's there. If somebody, if we don't, we want to question that, we can see it. Item 4B on the next page, I would delete recent because I don't know what's meant by recent. Is that 2 years old? I suggest we just leave it current photographs or video. Get down to 65221 B. We say that the permit can be used irrespective of open seasons. I suggest we give thought to whether a permit should be usable during hunting seasons. I know that's been discussed at the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, but I'm just suggesting to the rest of my colleagues here that we think about whether it should be allowed where you've got a, as an example, Mitch, you said the number one concern was potential abuse. You have somebody out in the stand hunting, it becomes dark, and they can't shoot, but then they turn on the spotlight and kill a giant buck, and you don't have, you have issues over notice. Or, unless somebody's actually there and sees that happen, there's no way you're going to prove that that was a violation of the law. And they can just say, I killed it before it got dark, but they actually used this permit. So I just ask people to think about whether we should allow it during rifle season, because this all started out, I attended the initial meeting with you in Lewakey. This concept started out because there were cotton farmers in the San Angelo area complaining about damage to cotton crops. And then it later expanded into wheat. And remember, we talked about it at that meeting, and I, for one, said I think this is going to lead to situations where people plant cool season crops as attractants and then use these permits as a way to game the system. So I suggest to you that we think about it. It may be that we live with it just as it is.
And the only thing, sorry to interrupt there also, is my understanding is, okay, I shoot that big buck, but I got to cut the horns, and I've got to give away the carcass. So what do I gain if I'm trying to abuse the system? I'm trying to understand that.
Assuming that they operate.
I kill the big buck in the middle of the night, but I don't get to keep it.
Assuming that they operate legally under the authority of this permit, then we believe the rules as proposed do remove that incentive or temptation for abuse. Assuming that they're operating legally under the permit.
Well, I want to back up one, because I want to assume these people are not lawbreakers. They've asked for a permit. We have gone out there with law enforcement and biologists. Is that correct? The way I understand it. And then they received the permit. After they've proven to us that they run a commercial operation that has depredation. Am I understanding this correctly?
You are, but I should, for the record, clarify one thing. Prior to permit issuance for white-tailed deer, we can certainly issue a permit before the wildlife biologist goes out there to verify that damage has occurred. Because as is written in the rule, we're requiring that attestation from the applicant that there's serious damage. And so he's signing a government document at that point. But it is our policy to follow that. If we're not able to go out immediately to inspect, it's our policy to follow up within 2 weeks. And if we see some red flags, if we're concerned at that time, the House Bill 1965 gives us the authority to cancel that permit at any time if we see that there's not indeed serious damage that has occurred.
But isn't it your, in answer to the chair's question, you don't envision sending biologists out to visit white-tailed deer applicants in most cases. Isn't that true?
No, sir, but it's partially true.
Pardon?
I don't envision sending the same biologist to visit the same farm year after year after year where we know that there's a problem, where we've seen evidence of a problem for years consecutively. But any place we're unfamiliar with, we do expect a site visit during that, at least the initial.
Right.
The permit may have been issued already, but within 2 weeks of then.
Yeah.
Well, I meant prior to issuance of the permit.
No, sir. Not for white-tailed deer. Not necessarily will we go out there prior to issuance.
But the affidavit has to be signed.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Let me ask, I think I mentioned this at the May meeting, that New Mexico has a similar statute that I'm told has been a nightmare for the state. Any of you had an opportunity to check to see anecdotally what they've learned or what regs they they may have used out there?
Yes, sir. Actually, there's quite a few states that have a depredation permit, especially in the southeast. And even with this proposal, we tend to be one of the more conservative states on this issue. But New Mexico has a process that's actually quite similar to what we have proposed here in many respects. They do require notification, for example. What they have there is it's similar to our desert big game species plan, in that when they get a call, the Game and Fish Department has to make recommendations to the landowner to perform some action to try and minimize that depredation problem prior to receiving a permit, such as, and I asked, I said, do you mean such as a high fence? He said, absolutely. In that case, they're talking about elk for the most part. And however, there's a statute that was passed, they call it the Jennings Amendment, that states that the applicant gets 1 year, and if he's not satisfied after a year of heeding those recommendations by the department, then the department must issue him this permit to kill an unlimited number of deer, very similar to what we have here. One of the differences is that the landowner must leave the animal lay in the field, but must notify the department right after the kill so that they can go and retrieve that carcass if they choose to. That was one of the biggest differences I noted in their process. But from a resource standpoint, they have no concerns. They mentioned two individuals that have killed, he said, dozens of elk under this permit that's allowed through statute. But they do not have a resource concern. But he did say very clearly that the hunters are well aware of this and are quite upset that these two individuals are allowed to kill so many elk that are no longer available for their hunting. So it's a concern amongst hunters in that state, without a doubt.
So they, New Mexico allows use of the permit during hunting seasons, and it has upset the hunters, or at least some hunters?
I don't want to say with certainty. Well, no, he did say for a 12-month period. So, yes, it is during a hunting season. But just the fact that they're allowed to kill that many elk and bull elks, I suppose, whether it's hunting season or not, has the hunters upset.
Okay. If I may continue.
Please. So
turn over to page 191 under 65.222A1, where we specify what the applicant must furnish. I think it ought to, it says physical address. I think it ought to be physical residence address. So we know where this person actually resides and doesn't just give us an office address. In B, I think I think that ought to say states under oath. We say swears to the truth, but in order to show a violation, Pete, you're nodding your head. Do you agree with that? It should say states under oath. And I think attestation should be changed to representation so that you're representing that serious damage is occurring to a commercial, et cetera.
Are you still in the same section?
He's down.
Yeah. Under,
he's down in B.
Okay, before
B.
you leave that area, let me know.
Sorry. All right,
before
I'm ready to leave that
Thanks.
Area.
Okay, one other thing that we were just discussing is, is there language in here that the shooter has, the actual shooter has to have a valid hunting license? I think from a safety standpoint, that should
be. A shooter does have to have a hunting license, but I need to refer to Major David Sinclair on where that's, which rule covers that specifically.
Okay.
But they must have a hunting license.
It is in here.
Without a doubt. I don't know that it's
not the permittee, but the shooter.
It's not in this proposal, I believe.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Major David Sinclair. The license requirement is actually in Chapter 42 of the code. The exceptions for the license are listed in there, like for coyotes or feral hogs, so it will apply. There is no exception for the deer depredation. It is in statute.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Duggins.
Okay, over on... the notice provision at the top of page 192, 65.225, of course, we've talked about the notice to the department. I think that a permittee should have to make a reasonable good faith effort to notify surrounding landowners if you're going to use this permit. For a couple of reasons. One, safety. Two is, and perhaps more importantly, if you have a landowner who doesn't know anything about a permit or that a permit's been issued, and they see a neighbor spotlighting deer, that's going to prompt, in my opinion, a call to the sheriff or the game warden that's unnecessary. So I don't know that you have to notify I'm not suggesting you have to notify the neighbor each time you use it, but you certainly ought to have to try to let them know you have a permit and will be using it over the course of the permit so that it doesn't, so there's, as I say, it would, I think, help out with safety issues, but also unnecessary calls. And I realize that was discussed, and Mitch, you can respond with.
Any other comments on that? You have an issue with that, Chairman Hall? A good faith effort,
well,
or some language
I assume you got all kinds of law enforcement issues on that, but Mitch, was that a discussion in the advisory group or any level?
Yes, sir. It was discussed quite a bit. I don't believe we discussed it much in the Wakey with the Crop Depredation Working Group, but the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee certainly did discuss this item, as well as some other items that Commissioner Duggins presented. On this item, there really wasn't much support from the advisory committee on notification of neighbors. There was some concern on how that process would work, how one that who leases the land for the farming activity is going to know all the neighbors, for example. And I'm just providing some different examples to you now that were discussed. And then the staff had some questions on how it would work administratively on our end if the permitting shop needs to confirm that all nine applicant or neighbors have been notified, or if it's just an attestation again, a signature, that we're just not real sure on how it would work from an administrative standpoint. But the advisory committee didn't address that as much as just didn't see much need, because the main comment was is if it's not going to result in a change of action, if my notifying my neighbor is not going to somehow result in me no longer getting to use this permit, then what good is it anyway? It's one of the comments we heard. I think the main thing to point before we, and I'm sure there'll be some more discussion on this, but I don't want to forget to mention this. If we do decide to make that, if the commission decides to make that requirement, that's something that would have to go back and be published again in the Texas Register for public comment.
But I think that it's one thing. One good result that could come from this is that it could facilitate discussions among landowners. That was one thing that we did talk about, is where their landowners don't know each other well or don't get along or haven't been willing to share in a high fence. Once an adjoining landowner knows you're about to use this permit, it may lead to some discussions that could avoid the use of the permit in the future. And I'm not suggesting it be a penal violation. I'm just suggesting that if the permit state that you agree, just a single civil covenant, you agree to make a reasonable good faith effort to notify surrounding landowners that you're obtaining a permit and will be using it over the whatever the term of the permit is. I'm not suggesting we turn it into a something Pete's got to pull out his .38 and go after him over.
Actually, I think that the advisory committee did make some comments in support of what you're suggesting, Commissioner, that it's always wise to encourage our permittees in situations like this to make such contacts.
So could that suggested language be stated in the application? So obviously that way people are aware of it, but would that constitute a material enough change to require a change in our process? Ann?
I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. That's one where the safest alternative would probably be to go back to the Texas Register. The way that this rule is structured, it's in several different sections, so the commission could go forward with everything else and just have a new section called notification of landowners or something to that effect. And I'm saying that's the safest thing. Obviously, there are arguments. The general law is if it's a logical outgrowth of the current rule. I think there's also concerns in terms of the folks that have previously discussed it and kind of, you know, right. sort of where we're going on this in terms of just our constituents and members of the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. I think we'd also want to make sure that they knew about it.
You would do that through an amendment in the register?
On that one, probably.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just saying that's the safest.
Because that's all we have to do is publish and just wait whatever the time
period
is. It'd
be the next commission meeting.
So we wouldn't.
Because
we
also, there's a. There's a notice and comment requirement for all rules that the commission makes.
Right.
And
right.
there's some law, not a lot, on how much you can change a proposal before it's actually adopted. Without going back through the notice and publication process. And it's basically, if it's a logical outgrowth, if it's not going to affect new groups or address new subjects, then those sorts of things can be done without going back.
If you were to say encourage landowners, at least this go-around, landowners are encouraged to, does that still...
Well, you know, the thing about that one is there's really, it doesn't do... Frankly, I mean it's a thing that we could probably do even without a rule. I mean, we can always just encourage.
Print it on the bottom of.
That's what I'm.
Yes, suggest that they strongly suggest that they notify their neighbors. There wouldn't be any teeth behind it really, in the sense that, you know, being able to go out and issue someone a citation because they applied for a permit and didn't notify their neighbors or try to.
That might be a difficult enforceability issue anyway. So,
I think it'd be very difficult.
What I'm suggesting,
Big Brother thing, either.
Right? Yeah. What I'm suggesting though is that if the consensus is to require that as a covenant or a commitment to the permit, that if the next year we determine that a permittee hasn't done any of that, then that would be an additional ground added to permit denial 65.230. That if you could use that as a basis to deny the permit.
Well, then you'd have to go.
If there's going to be a penalty associated with it,
anyway.
I would recommend that we be really careful in terms of going the safest route in terms of notice and comment on the rule.
Gotcha.
Commissioner Morin, did you have a...
No, I just agree that, you know, it's a good idea to make a reasonable effort to let somebody know what you're doing. Cause.
And Vice Chairman, on your comment as far as would that go in the application, I mean, that's something we could certainly do right now, is when we start sending out an application packet that has all the bullets of what it takes to receive this permit, et cetera, we could include a statement in there about we highly encourage those permittees to notify neighboring landowners.
And at
it
least
won't
for
be
the purposes of this year, we could, you know, it could be an operating procedure for the visiting biologist to communicate that as well.
That's true. One thing I've learned over the years is that a lot of farmers have made it clear that they want their neighbors to know, because the farmers want the high fence there and they want the neighbors to help build that high fence. So I don't...
I'm of the view that we need to take action on it tomorrow and make some headway with this. But if we can, you know, if it's a substantial issue, we'll have a way of cleaning it up later. I think if I've got support for that.
Can't we go ahead and take a vote on it as is, and then in November consider this additional?
Yes, as is. I'm looking for my nod from Ann. As is, with the changes that are not considered material differences that we've already discussed, correct? We probably should review that tomorrow.
Again, I'm for the record, Ambright General Counsel. And there are a couple of changes I know that we've talked about, several, and we really do appreciate Commissioner Duggins communicating those to us in advance, so staff has had an opportunity to really kind of go through those and try to determine which ones might require going back to the Texas Register. And the only two we really identified that probably, you know, again, the safest alternative would be to go back to the Texas Register would be the minimum acreages and the notification of neighbors. Most of the other ones, like open season. We've already, there's already something in the rule about how we're going to, this department is going to determine the period of validity. So that's the change that could be made or not. And then the other notification provision, actually this one that y'all talked about, those could be made without going back to the Texas Register.
Okay, thank you. So with the addition of the changes that that we've suggested, that the commission has suggested today, we would, my recommendation is that we go ahead with it.
Mr. Chairman, another couple of concerns before we. Are there any special safety concerns with people shooting at night that need to be addressed?
I'd like to defer to Major Sinclair on that question, if I may.
I'm Major David Sinclair. Commissioner, with the hunting we have now, we have fur-bearing animal hunting at night. We've got the predator hunting. We've got feral hunting, and there's no regulations other than the hunter ed requirement that we have in place. So, there's always that concern, but and generally speaking, the commission doesn't have authority to adopt regulations related to safety. There are a couple of areas, but generally across the board, don't have that authority.
And my second question would be, do we have the ability to pull a permit before the end of the term of the permit?
Yes, sir, we do. That is very clear in House Bill 1965. We may cancel a permit at any time for, and I don't have it open to that page right now, but for a number of reasons, including that the permit is not meeting its intended purpose, or whether there was falsification of a document. And it gives us quite a bit of latitude there to cancel a permit at any time.
And let we fought through all this in the legislature too. I mean, we knew this was going to create its own set of issues, and so Carter and lots of other people, as this was going through the legislature, we tried to get, for lack of a better term, as much control of it in our hands to be able to make decisions, because we know it's probably going to be an evolving issue over the next few years till we all figure this out.
I don't want to introduce a brand new idea here, but in all fairness to the Whitetail Advisory Committee and all members, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that we did receive one suggestion on this topic about perhaps the simplest way of notifying neighbors is with signage, such as signs on the gate. That did not result in much discussion to follow, but it was mentioned, and I thought it'd be fair for me to mention that to this commission.
Commissioner Duncan.
I got two other observations. At the top of page 193, where we talk about the log that the permittee has to maintain. Five, we say the disposition of the wildlife to include the name of the person. I think it ought to say include with the name, phone, and physical residence address, so we can actually follow up if necessary. I did give you that, didn't I, Mitch?
Yes, sir. That's not a surprise.
And then finally, in six.
Yeah, right.
Page 194 under 652324, where we talk about it would be prohibited to offer, accept money or anything of value in connection with activities under the permit. I would expand that a little bit with this phrase, and I think I gave this to you, Mitch, including any fee paid in exchange for hunting, game meat, or antlers associated with or resulting from such activities. How do you feel about that? You didn't really say, or Clayton, you didn't really respond, I don't think.
As you say, I think it's really a clarification of our intent. And
I mean, that's consistent with the intent, isn't it?
I believe it is. And it's certainly something that could be adopted tomorrow without having to go back to the Texas Register.
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Any other comments or questions on this? Thank you all very much. Mitch, thank you. Clayton, thank you.
Thank you.
So, no further questions or discussions. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Committee item number 7, deer breeder rules, possession of deer from out-of-state sources, permission to publish proposed rules in the Texas Register. Kevin and Mitch.
Lucky guy.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. I'm not presenting anything on depredation this morning, so we'll maybe go through this a little quicker. For the record, my name is Kevin Schwash. I'm the Big Game Program Specialist, and this morning I will present an item concerning the current prohibition on the importation of white-tailed deer and mule deer into the state on the continuing basis of concerns about transmissible diseases. Under the Parks and Wildlife Code, the commission is authorized to regulate the possession of deer held in captivity under a deer breeder's permit and the procedures and requirements for the purchase, transfer, sale, and shipment of breeder deer. Current rules do not allow for the importation of white-tailed deer and mule deer into the state. In March of 2009, the United States Department of Agriculture published a proposed rules that would create a single federal regulatory standard to replace the various state regulations imposed in response to chronic wasting disease. Although the current breeder rule was promulgated in 2005 in response to concerns over CWD, in the process of evaluating the current proposed USDA rule, we recognize that our current entry prohibition has served as a comprehensive deer disease management strategy, and we want to clarify on the record that our current entry prohibition is intended to mitigate numerous disease threats to our Texas deer herds. In publishing this proposal, which may be a simple readoption of the current rule, it will help us demonstrate to others that there are many disease risks for deer and other wildlife in addition to CWD. Staff has been concerned about other epidemiological threats such as exotic blue tongue, epizootic hemorrhagic disease, malignant catarrhal fever, and one that's out in Western California, it's adenovirus hemorrhagic disease. These are all viruses that affect deer or can be passed from deer to other wildlife or livestock species. Staff therefore recommends the continued closure of the state to the importation of white-tailed deer and mule deer. We are proposing this amendment because we believe the rationale for the basis of this rule should not be narrowly focused on CWD, but rather be a more comprehensive analysis of numerous disease threats. The White-tailed Deer Advisory Committee was briefed on this proposal, and they are support the current border closure. Therefore, we are seeking permission to publish the rules for public comment concerning amendments to the Deer Breeder Proclamation. And with that, that concludes my presentation. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Thanks, Kevin. Any questions on that?
That's straightforward.
Okay. That was easy.
That was awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was easy. Yet you took the wrong one.
All right. I will authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. And, Mr. Chairman, I think that concludes our business.
Thank you, Chairman Freakin.